We have another picture today of how the pandemic has affected the economy. The United States added a record 4.8 million jobs in June. It's a partial recovery from the shutdown months of March and April. But we received this June snapshot in July, when soaring infections are forcing some businesses to close again already. NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley has the big picture for us. Hi there, Scott.
Good morning, Steve.
Let's start with the new jobs report. What's it say?
More than 2 million of those new jobs that were added last month were in leisure and hospitality, you know, bars, restaurants, entertainment. That's a sector that was really hard hit early in the pandemic. It's making a shaky comeback now. Likewise, retailers added more than 700,000 jobs in June as stores reopened. Factories added more than 350,000 jobs. Even government added some jobs after big cuts in the two previous months. The unemployment rate, Steve, ticked down a bit to 11.1%, and the biggest improvement there was for Latino workers. African Americans saw a smaller drop, and in fact, the jobless rate among African Americans is now the highest in the country at 15.4%. Wow. There was some talk last month that the official unemployment rate was artificially low because some people who were out of work were being misclassified as employed.
Yes.
The Labor Department says there's still some of that going on, but the problem is shrinking. Even if you discount the misclassification, there is a clear downward trend in the unemployment rate. Now, that said, unemployment is still really high by historical standards. And just today, we got word that another 1.4 million people applied for state unemployment benefits last week.
So rather than Great Depression levels of unemployment, which some people feared, we're merely having, if I can put it that way, very severe recession levels of employment at this point, a little over 11%, and some improvement. But at the same time, Scott, infections have gone up. There was a record number of people reported with coronavirus yesterday, more than 50,000. How does that change the job picture?
It certainly complicates it. I spoke this week with Sixto Zermano. He's one of those new workers from June. He's a bellman at a resort in Las Vegas. He was out of work for several months during the spring and then went back to work early last month when casinos reopened. He'd only been back on the job a few days, though, when he got sick with the coronavirus. And while he's feeling better now, he's still in quarantine.
I was never scared, you know, getting the virus. I'm a hard worker, so this is, every time you go to work, I'm going to go to work. But I feel nervous now because how contagious this is. I never knew how easy this spreads.
The union that represents Zermano has filed a lawsuit against several casino operators saying they're not doing enough to protect their employees. And it's a sign, Steve, of just how precarious this moment is, both in terms of people's health and also the health of the broader economy.
Well, Scott, when you tell me that 2 million of the new jobs or the added jobs in June were in areas like hospitality and restaurants, that makes me wonder what's happening now as governors in some states have to shut down restaurants again.
Right. Those new shutdown orders are not reflected in today's report. So you could say these numbers are a little bit stale, even though the report just came out within the hour. This is a snapshot of the job market as it was about 3 weeks ago in the middle of June. And since that time, in the week since then, we've seen bars shuttered a second time in Texas, Florida, large swaths of California. Arizona's closed bars, as well as gyms and water parks and movie theaters for the next month. We've also learned during this pandemic that even if there isn't a shutdown order from the government, whenever there's a spike in new infections, people get more cautious about going out and spending money. Bartender Karen Schenk saw that drop in the business at the bar where she works in Tucson.
You go from making $80 in tips in a couple of hours, and now you're doing $15. We're risking our health for peanuts. That's where that whole fight with yourself inside is of, I love my boss. I want him to succeed. I love my health. I want to keep it.
And Steve, as more states are now struggling with the acceleration of infections, we're likely to hear more stories like that. It just underscores the message. We aren't going to get a robust economic recovery until we get control of this virus.
Scott, thanks for the insights.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley.
Okay, so what do new fundraising numbers tell us about the presidential race?
There is something revealing in the numbers for June. An incumbent president usually raises more than a challenger. Money follows power, which the president has. And incumbents are usually favored to win re-election. But in June, the usual pattern was reversed. Democrat Joe Biden's campaign raised $141 million, which is a little bit more than the president did.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is on the line. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
So we got Biden's numbers last night, $141 million. That's big. How'd he and the Democrats pull that in?
So in June, they say that 68% of the donors were brand new to the campaign and that the overall donation was $34. Campaigns like to emphasize the small dollar amount. Yeah. But the reality is he also had some big fundraisers, including with Senators Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, a really big one with former President Obama that brought in something like $11 million all in one fundraiser. And it's important to point out that this all comes in the context of the pandemic that Scott was just talking about. This was a quarter of fundraising solidly in the pandemic with millions of Americans out of work. But for Biden, these fundraising numbers are another data point that go with poll after poll after poll, both national and state polls, showing that he has an advantage, a significant advantage at this moment in time against President Trump.
President Trump and Republicans also raised a lot in June, $131 million. So not as much, but a big number. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, so the Trump campaign had been boasting about these numbers just a few hours before the Biden campaign announced theirs. And in fact, these are really good numbers, just not quite as good as what Biden and the Democrats put together. The Trump campaign is also emphasizing that it was largely grassroots fundraising, digital mail, online donations. There were a couple of in-person fundraisers that President Trump held, his first since the pandemic. And, you know, the other thing that they talk about, I talked to a major fundraiser for the Trump campaign who said, yeah, and this was right after the Tulsa rally. Yes, the rally attendance wasn't great, but look at the fundraising. Look at all this grassroots fundraising. I asked, well, Biden's campaign seems to be doing pretty well with fundraising. They said, look at cash in the bank, cash on hand. And the Trump campaign has nearly $300 million in the bank, in part because they started raising money almost as soon as President Trump entered office. They basically never stopped. The Biden campaign has not disclosed its figure yet for cash on hand.
So we're 4 months out from the election. How are the campaigns using this money?
Ads. Yeah. The Trump campaign just booked a bunch of ads in states that he won last year, booked ads for the fall, showing him to be in more of a defensive crouch.
White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
In Seattle, an experiment has ended.
Police dismantled the Capitol Hill Occupation Protest, C-H-O-P. Everybody called it CHOP. It was a couple of blocks in the middle of the city. Protesters demanding police reform occupied that area about a month ago and said no police were welcome. Their informal promise was the protesters would police themselves. But in the past 2 weeks, there were two shootings in the occupied area. Here's Police Chief Carmen Best.
What we can't have is what we saw there, where people were entrenched, where crimes and lawlessness were occurring.
People who did not leave when the police moved in were arrested.
Casey Martin of member station KUOW was there when police cleared the area. Hi, Casey.
Hi, good morning.
So what happened yesterday? What did this look like?
Yeah, this was early in the morning. The mayor of Seattle, Jenny Durkan, ordered that police go back into this area to clear out all of the camps. Dozens of people were sleeping in their tents right when it happened, right outside of a police precinct, and they were told that they could either leave or be arrested. And many of them grabbed their few belongings and left, but some insisted on staying, and right away, over 20 people were arrested by police. Once people were cleared out of that zone, the city also sent in crews to take down all of the art and the tents and everything that had accumulated. 3 weeks worth of food stands and supply stations, all of this was dismantled and taken away. And police closed off all the entrances into the protest zone, and in less than an hour, an area that for weeks was police-free was suddenly only police.
You know, this was one of those stories I read about, and I thought, gosh, I wish I could see what it looked like. What was it like without the police there?
Well, you know, this time last month, there were days of protests, essentially a standstill between police and protesters facing each other outside of the precinct building. There was tear gas and rubber bullets. And then pretty abruptly, the police were abandoned the building. They were taken out of the area. And when they left, the activists stayed. And within 24 hours, they set up their own road barriers. There was a food co-op. Artists painted every available surface, including they painted Black Lives Matter in huge letters down the street. Volunteer medic stations started setting up, as well as security, even armed security. They formed this little community right in the middle of a residential area. A lot of apartments are also in this protest area, a few restaurants as well, and they suddenly found themselves right in the heart of it.
And then, as Steve mentioned, in the past 2 weeks, there were two shootings. Is that what made the police decide it's time to clear this out?
Absolutely. This was a very peaceful area for weeks, but the multiple shootings in the last couple of weeks, two teenagers were killed. And since then, residents were voicing that, you know, we do support the Black Lives Matter movement, but a lot of people are saying we haven't slept in weeks, we're not feeling very safe at night, and we're welcoming police back into the area. Even before the second shooting, the police chief was saying, you know, enough is enough, it's time for people to go home.
Okay, so some of these protesters, as you said, were taken into custody yesterday. They'll be in jail for a while, we presume. What about the rest of the protest movement? Do you think they're just going to set up somewhere else?
Absolutely not. I left there and people were still outside. They had lined up across the street from the police. And people said, you know, this wasn't about a single location. This is about a movement and it'll keep moving no matter where it goes.
Fascinating. Casey Martin of KUOW. Thanks so much, Casey.
You're welcome.